You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Andrew Schlecht is in the building. And the show today is going to be really fun. It's a little bit of a different style show. After a quick little intro and a quick topic I want to talk about after last night's NBA Finals game, I'm just handing the show over to Schlecht. And we're going to have a great time.
I'll take it. I will take Schlecht.
Schlecht gets to come on. He's going to host, and he's going to be the one that asks questions instead of me. Shit, half the time I don't really ask questions on this show, but like, yeah. You know, I'm going to let Andrew just like bludgeon me with questions about these draft prospects for a while.
Yeah, I think your listeners will be very excited that you aren't asking me about the draft prospects. So it should be this way, and it's going to be very fun.
Well, the reason that I wanted to do this was I specifically asked you about this. Because I think that the best way to do this is to have somebody that is extremely informed on the NBA draft, which I think is like undeniable that you are extremely informed on what's going on with the NBA draft, but also somebody that is going to be able to like pinpoint specific things, right? Mm-hmm. Because look, you are, I guess, like, I don't know, like, you're like above the level of layman, like when it comes to the draft.
So yeah, I would like to think so, but yeah, no, I think that's right. Like, I know who all these guys are, and I've watched 50 to 100 synergy clips on like the top 30. Yeah. And like, that's like, I just have a good feel for who they are. Do I know every little nook and cranny of who they are like you do? No. But I do have a good feel for who these guys are.
Right. So I think that it's going to be really fun just to hand the show over to you. You're going to ask questions because half the time me and Adam, like, I feel like I can get so bogged down in the weeds on shit. Mm-hmm. Like, I talk about this all the time with our like bigger boss, Chris Brow.
Yeah.
Chris is really, really good at like centering me and like making me remember like, oh no, like people don't really care that Kobe Bufkin can finish at the rim at a really high level and like do X, Y, and Z, right? They want to know about fucking Victor Wembanyama. Like that's who they want to know.
Like, he's good at centering you back to the to like the fans that are like majority of NBA fans and not like psychopaths like me. Because I'm very interested in Kobe Bufkin's rim finishing. Very interested.
Yeah, I mean, you're the king Bufkin boy. You are a Bufkin believer. And
that's right.
It's really exciting. It's really exciting to be able to do this. And I'm sure we will talk about Kobe Bufkin later on because you love Kobe. And I feel like there's no way you didn't set up questions about Kobe for this thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We're definitely talking Bufkin. No question.
So before we get to Kobe and to, I guess, all the other prospects that aren't Kobe Bufkin, there's a thing I wanted to talk to you first about that kind of came up while I was watching the NBA Finals last night. And then I started getting like text messages. I got like, I think it was like two or three like high level decision makers. And then like another executive hit me while Christian Brown was going off in the NBA Finals. Because people know that I was like across the league, people know that I was like very high on Christian Brown. I think I had him higher than anybody in the public sphere. And then ended up with him like three or four spots. I forget what I said yesterday on the podcast when I actually looked it up, like three or four spots lower than Oshae Igbaji, when Igbaji the whole time was considered this like super high level prospect in a different like tier than Christian Brown. And I just didn't really believe that to an extent.
Yeah.
So
sure.
People started hitting me and asking me like, well, okay, Christian Brown is here. He's making like a very clear impact in the finals. Is there a value to drafting older at this point? And then my gears started turning and trying to figure these things out. And then I would go back to them and say, actually, I think there might be in the new collective bargaining agreement, given how valuable being able to get rookie scale production is going to be,
sure,
with how difficult it is to add to your team via the trade market or via free agency after a certain point, if you hit like the second level of the tax apron, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You need somebody that's like, has the chance to be above a minimum type of player on your roster that's making about that money. And that's what you can do with like a late first round pick, or second round picks are going to be crazy valuable. I think going forward, if you can nail a second round pick, it's going to be amazing. But I think the points taken in the first round is first round too.
And I do really wonder if we see, so that leads to a couple more questions now that like, after getting those kind of text messages, like kind of jogged my brain a little bit in terms of the way that, you know, this part of it like isn't being asked questions by like GMs or like talking to people about this or anything. This is just me like kind of thinking about this a little bit more now. And I wonder if this leads to guys like Ben Shepherd or Kobe Brown or Omax Prosper. Or Andre Jackson or Colby Jones or Marcus Sasser.
Yeah. Jaime Jaquez.
Jaime Jaquez going a little bit higher on draft night. And then the projecty guys like Rayon Rupert, Julian Phillips, Jordan Walsh, you know, James Nnaji's kind of a different deal because he's a stash player, but like, or could be a stash player. I
don't know. Sissoko, even though he's kind of falling already, but.
Yeah, CD Sissoko. Honestly, like even some of these like freshmen, like Keontae George, Nick Smith, Jet Howard, Dariq Whitehead, Bryce Sensabaugh, like
Clintman,
Bobby Clintman. Do some of these older players end up going higher than some of those younger guys when like all year on mock drafts, it's been, you know, consensus that, oh, like these young freshmen are in a different tier, you know, it's a totally different ball game. And to be honest with you, like they aren't really in a different tier for me and like just kind of haven't been. Like I've already filed like the draft guide and like I've done some like subtle adjustments in terms of rankings and stuff. But like I've had like, you know, Ben Shepherd, Colby Jones, Jaime Jaquez, Omax Prosper, et cetera, in the same tier as Jet Howard, Keontae George, Nick Smith, you know, et cetera, for a while now. So I don't know, like I'm just kind of saying words. What are, when I say all of these things, like, does this, is this like a potential theory that we could see play out like moving forward?
I think it's possible. However, even though players are older and maybe you can project them a little bit, it doesn't always mean they're good. That's know? And so I just think about Jacob Evans, who was drafted by the Warriors years ago.
And by the way, I really like Jacob Evans. I was very wrong.
When they got him, I thought, and as somebody that was following the Thunder as like purely a fan at the time, I was just like, I was mad that they got him, know? And so, and a lot of people are sitting at home like, what are you talking about, you psycho? Like, who's Jacob Evans? He looked like somebody that was just ready to go, that was ready to play. And the truth was, he was never going to play in the NBA. Like, it just wasn't going to work. And so I think to an extent, this could be true. I think about last year's draft. So who's outside of Christian Brown, who else would have moved up? And like, even how far should Christian Brown have moved up? Like, what team should have taken him? Like, maybe the Bulls at 18 are a team that makes sense. But then and I still like the Hawks taking AJ Griffin. I still like that, even though he's like 2 years younger. So I still think it's going to be about taking the players that are the best, and typically the best players are the younger guys for the most part.
Andrew, like, you're way overthinking this specifically. Like,
yeah,
Jalen Williams is an example.
Jalen Williams, yes, it's true. 21 years old. He was a junior.
Both Jalen Williamses are an example of this.
Both of, yeah, true. Yeah. Even the Jay Will, he's actually younger than J-Dub by like almost 2 years, I think. He's one specifically, and like Christian Coloco, I think, was a little older too.
He's one that I think is a little more limited, but you're right. Yeah. Keegan Murray somebody is that, another example of this, for what it's worth.
How much higher could Keegan Murray have gone, though?
He couldn't have gone higher, but like drafting older is a good.
Like
someone who's older.
Sure.
Andrew Nembhard is one. Walker Kessler is like, I think he was like 20. He wasn't like, you know, a unpolished freshman, let's go with, entering the draft early necessarily. Yeah.
But I was going to say, but people weren't wrong about Kessler because of his age, were they?
No, it was just limitation at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Tari Eason was certainly like a very, maybe the better phrase is like player that has already been productive in college basketball, as opposed to like pure full scale project, right? Because like Tari Eason, Christian Brown, Andrew Nembhard, you know, these guys ended up being pretty good picks at the end of the day. I actually think that in the 2022 draft, more of those guys hit so far than didn't hit. Like Johnny Davis is like the prime example of someone who it seems like is not going to hit. But then like Jake LaRavia, I still like kind of am okay with Jake LaRavia, but I don't think it's like unfair to say that, hey, this guy did not play all that well. But you know who did? The guy that they way heavily reached on, in my opinion, David Roddy.
David Roddy, so,
I don't know. Yeah. Like, is there a blend of like productive age that you can project just stepping into a role from day one? Like, does that become a little bit more valuable, even if the upside might be a little bit more muted?
I think this is probably just comes down to draft philosophy for each team. I think there are probably teams that have thought this way for a long time. That just they just think like, hey, we're drafting production. I'm not going to go with the mystery box. And then you have teams that are willing to, like you were talking about, gamble. You know, in order to hit at the highest of highs, you're going to have to gamble at some level.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just comes down to philosophy. I think a team like the Thunder, we've seen that they're way more willing to gamble and way more willing to take losses when they need to. But they're also willing to, you know, when they do connect, it's like, wow, you know, years ago, it was Serge Ibaka that it connected really well for them.
Yep.
And they got a guy in the 20s that became a staple for their team. And so I think just team philosophies probably won't change because of the CBA, but you could see guys maybe go a few spots higher. Like maybe Dalen Terry doesn't go to the Bulls.
Yeah.
You know, like something that might be altered from last year is like maybe they decide to be the Christian Brown destination instead and go that way. So I think it's probably like maybe like one or two slots that are changed because of this type of thinking, but I don't think it's going to change the draft by any stretch.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I just wonder if some of it only changes the end of or like the bottom, you know, 12 picks of the first round, right? We're not talking about these guys that are, you know, potential lottery picks, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But I think we are, frankly, kind of talking about guys like Keontae George and Jet Howard and Nick Smith, who like are quite flawed, weren't frankly all that good as freshmen. If you like really dive in, like Keontae was like, you know, box score productive. You know, Nick Smith was not productive. Jet Howard shot really well, I think is reasonable to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. These are the things that like that kind of just ran through my mind when I was talking about this. And by the way, I shot this theory by a good friend of the program, John Hollinger. And mm-hmm. John's reaction was immediately what your initial one was. I'm kind of sharing something he told me privately, but I don't think he would mind me doing this. He basically just said like drafting old hasn't really worked previously.
Yeah.
He did mention mm-hmm. though, something that I do think is interesting. Does the influx of NIL money lead to more older players staying in the draft longer or staying in college longer, which means there's just a greater talent pool in the college sphere? I think that's actually an interesting concept. Yeah.
Yeah, it should. It should. And maybe that helps you identify these guys a little bit easier too, yeah. Theoretically, because maybe you get better players that stay a couple years and then you can just more easily identify them. You know, like if Isaac Okoro stayed another year at Auburn because he got a bunch of NIL money, maybe he doesn't go. Maybe it's not good for him. But I think NBA teams may have been able to better identify what kind of player he was going to be. Maybe same for Pat Williams, although like his injury history has not been kind to him. But still, like players like that, you know, where there's like a mystery behind them of what they could be. You know, some guys it could be really good for. You know, like if. Even if like Halliburton or Devin Vassell or somebody from that class stayed, like those guys, if you just got to see a little bit more of them, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, those guys should be top eight or whatever.
No, I think that's really, really probably true, to be honest. And it's like the guys to me that like, I think it is Christian Brown stayed. You know, Christian Brown theoretically could have left after his sophomore year. He was like a pretty reasonable, good rotation player in Kansas and had interest. Like I talked to an agent last night representing a player that, you know, is in the Christian Brown range of the draft, let's say. And he was like, yeah, I think like Christian Brown is like helping my client tonight. Right.
Yeah.
And I was like, honestly, yeah, I think you're right. I think that what he's doing is pretty valuable and shows that like you can come in and play immediately and be pretty useful. So yeah, I don't know.
I think teams will continue to miss on older players. I think it will continue to happen.
Yeah.
Like Jalen Brunson went 33rd in the draft. People missed on him because he was small. He was a little older.
Desmond Bane as well.
Desmond Bane and the couple classes later, like there's just going to be guys that every team goofs on, you know, and somebody just picks them up at the end of the draft. But yeah, I think it could shift things slightly. But yeah.
Okay. Let's take a quick commercial break and then. I'm sliding over the controls to Andrew, folks.
Yeah.
It's happening. Andrew gets to host the show. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Schlecht. Taking the controls of the podcast. We're going to go through prospects. We're going to go from the top. We're going to go down. We'll get through as many prospects as we can as to what feels reasonable. But I'm going to ask you just about weaknesses. Like why you either are going to talk me out of why I feel nervous about a certain aspect of a player or tell me why it's valid. Okay, so we'll start with Victor Wembanyama. Obviously, he looks like a video game created player when you're watching him. He's ridiculous. Everything is awesome about him. But what would you say to people that say, hey, he's 7'5"? 7'5" guys have durability issues. What would you say about his durability issues overall?
So I guess I would say that anybody who is 7'5", it does not bother me to bring up the idea of these guys potentially getting hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And for what it's worth, Victor Wembanyama has previously dealt with injuries. He stayed completely healthy this year. I think in part, and it's speculative based on the part of NBA teams, that part of why Wembanyama was able to stay so healthy this season is because he played once a week. with Metropolitans, or once every, you know, 5 to 6 days or whatever it was, as opposed to playing with Osvel the year before, where they were playing both Euro League and French League. So in December 2020, he suffered a stress fracture in his leg. November 2021, suffered a broken finger. December 2021, he had a right shoulder blade bone bruise that forced him to miss a month. In June 2022, he suffered like a muscle injury, like in his core area, if I remember correctly, that forced him to miss like the rest of the French playoffs. So these things have come up with him previously. I don't think it makes him injury prone by any stretch, but I do think that there is, it's at least worth mentioning. It doesn't change him being the number one overall pick in this 2023 NBA draft by any stretch.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if people want to bring that up, I don't have an issue with that. I don't think that's an unfair question.
Yeah. No, I think it makes sense to touch upon it, but also just say, hey, this is a ridiculous prospect that has to be taken number one. So please, I refuse to talk any more about it. We're going to move on to Scoot Henderson. And I guess my question with Scoot is, will his size and possible inefficiency with scoring the basketball hinder him from being a star?
In terms of being a star, no, I don't think it will.
Okay.
I think that there are some inherent limitations that smaller players present in the playoffs. Now, he is someone that I think particularly is pretty well suited to be able to overcome those inherent limitations. In my opinion, the inherent limitations that smaller NBA players tend to face are strength-based and length-based, right?
Yeah.
Well, Scoot Henderson is built like a fucking Mack truck and has a 6'9" wingspan for a guard. I would guess that his standing reach is probably in like the 8'3"-ish range.
Yeah.
Something 8'4", which is small to be certain, but like Christian Brown's standing reach is like 8'4", if I remember correctly. Sure. There are ways to get around that. I think Scoot is so strong and physically stout through his lower half and core that unless you're like Luka, you're not going to just like bury him on the block, right? Mm-hmm. Or unless you're Nikola Jokic and you get a peel switch against Scoot, you're not just going to bury him, right? Yeah. Like, I don't think Paul George would be able to bury him on the block in the mid-range.
Okay.
As good as Paul George is, like Paul George just has like a higher center of gravity. And I think that Scoot would be able to like push him out. Right.
Yeah.
I do think that there are real questions in terms of like specific matchups that he could be presented with in the playoffs that could cause him issues. Like if he gets drafted to Portland and they just continue to run into like the Luka Doncic led Dallas Mavericks and he's just hammering switches constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like that could be a specific matchup based problem, but I don't think that if you are the Portland Trailblazers or Charlotte Hornets for that regard, in my opinion, I would take him if I was Charlotte.
Yeah.
I don't think you can look at specific matchups. I think you need to look at this guy's really fucking good and just take him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess I didn't answer anything about the efficiency, did I?
Well, I mean, what do you think about his shooting?
Overall. I think it's way overblown in terms of the shooting issue.
Yeah.
In part, it's because people in the draft media sphere keep trotting out this number that he's a 27% three-point shooter.
Yeah.
And he's not. He shot 32% from three this year. Like that actually happened. If you know how to read the G League stats, he actually shot 32% from three. This is not me like trying to come up with a number. Genuinely, if you look at all of the games, including the showcase games, which are also regular season games in the G League, he shot 32% from three.
Yeah.
Particularly as well, if you look at the numbers in terms of what happened with him if he, or after, I guess is the way to put it, after he hurt his ankle. The numbers, I'm like trying to pull them up right now. So he injured his ankle on January 17th. Before then, he was shooting 35% from three. After that, he shot 28% from three. Before that, he shot 40% between 8 and 20 feet. After mm-hmm. that, he shot 33% between 8 and 20 feet.
Hmm.
I think that people are getting a little bit too bogged down in the percentages and not recognizing that he's actually just got like a very comfortable mid-range game. He's super yeah. polished getting into that area and pulling up. And some of those end up being high degree of difficulty shots. And then the shooting from three needs to improve. I will absolutely not begrudge anybody for saying otherwise. I think it needs to get better, but I think the base is already there for it to get better.
Yeah. I saw him play in person a couple times here in OKC against the Blue.
Yeah.
And he was so interesting in one of the games because he just kind of hung back for three and a half quarters and just kind of let the Ignite do their thing. And then he was like, okay, this is over. And he took the ball, and I think he scored on like six consecutive possessions in six yeah. different ways. And it was just like, we're done here. Like this, it's well, I'm going to kill you. It's over.
That's the other thing too that like annoys me a little bit. I think that the people who don't get how good Scoot is are the people that like didn't go to games or like didn't watch full G League games, right? Mm-hmm. Like Scoot this year really did kind of keep it in neutral at times because the goal for him was not to win basketball games. Like Victor Wembanyama is competing for something right now.
Yeah.
He is competing yeah, yeah. for the French League Championship. The G League Ignite program is expressly exists in order for these kids to get drafted high.
Yeah.
Scoot Henderson is going to get drafted high no matter what the fuck he does this year.
Mission accomplished. Like yeah. day one. This year, and you could kind of see it because he was not giving it his all, and definitely like in person, you watch him like, oh, like this guy's built, like he's insane,
yeah.
And then, yeah. but he can go get buckets. I mean, he made it look really easy. There was for most of the game, I was like, wait, where is he? Like, what's going on here? Like, that's Scoot Henderson, and then he just erupts, and you're like, oh, okay, I see it. I see yeah. why. I agree with you. I think Charlotte should take him. I think the thought of picking somebody for fit at two is the silliest thing ever. Just don't ever do that. Just take the guy Completely you think agree. You who's going to be the best. Let's talk about Brandon Miller. First, there's a lot of conflicting information, and I don't even know if you can speak to any of this, but just the whole issue with the charges that were on his friends, that he was just kind of a part of this whole ordeal. How much is that weighing on teams, if at all?
I think teams certainly want to try and gather more information. And I think that the teams at the top of the draft, you know, certainly are. Like, I know that John Cavoni reported that Charlotte has like sent someone down to Tuscaloosa in order to like yeah. try and do intel and like learn more about this if they can. I think that they really do want to know more.
Yeah.
I think that if nothing changes in regard to like the material information that they know, it won't impact him in terms of where okay. he's drafted.
Yeah.
I think that that's maybe the easiest way to say it because yeah. he is a cooperating witness. He is not a, and this is all according to, the Tuscaloosa Police Department and everything. He's a cooperating witness. He is not someone that is considered a suspect in this crime. Yeah. Not crime, I'm sorry, Alec, in this shooting that occurred. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly I don't want to get sued on the podcast because
I was going to say,
this is not yet a murder.
Something that we're good at talking about, obviously. Yeah.
Well, like, look, yeah. I've gotten okay at talking about this because I've had to do it so much now.
Yeah, it's just touchy though. It's just, and it's something that you never want to have to talk about with a prospect. And I just, in particular, I just I don't know. I just wonder if Charlotte, they've just had so many issues with several players on their roster that have had just issues with the law. And so I just wonder.
Yeah, so part of this is that all of the intel on Brandon Miller before this incident happened was fine. It was all like good. And like, he's not like, my impression is that he is not a bad kid. I don't know Brandon Miller. I have not like talked to him at all. So I can't like answer this, but my impression is that NBA teams certainly did not view him as like a bad kid. Certainly did not view him as any sort of like intel based question mark. So yeah, I think that's worth noting here, and why I think they're a little bit more willing to look at this with an eye toward what his role was, trying to understand his role as opposed to like outright dismissing it, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. How does Brandon Miller become an NBA All-Star? What does that look like?
Yeah, he has to finish. He has to finish at the rim, point blank.
Yeah.
This is why I actually ended up with him a touch lower than where other people are on him. I'm quite worried about Brandon Miller's finishing at the basket. And he got much better this season throughout the course of the season. And I think that's really important as we're trying to understand guys who are going to show like real tangible growth. One thing I really like to look for is how they process coaching and how they like clearly work through their weaknesses through a season. This is honestly why I'm so high on Leonard Miller. I think the way Leonard Miller processes information and coaching is really, really positive. You could see it in the way that he grew from the beginning to the end of the season. Brandon Miller got much better on this over the course of the beginning to the end of the season. Here's the problem. What do you I'll ask you this. Trivia time for Andrew Schlecht, even though I know that you're hosting now. What do you think Brandon Miller shot in half-court settings this year at the basket?
At the basket? Oh gosh, this makes me think it's low. 36%. I don't know.
Yeah, no. So you even went lower than what is normal. It's not that low. It's like 39.5%.
That's really bad. I was gonna say somewhere in the 40s, but then my brain said go lower, and I did. But yeah, that's not great.
It's actually like egregiously low for someone who is this level of prospect. So I went back and looked at like other high-end wing creators, right? Everyone thinks that like Jason Tatum like had no game at the rim when he was at Duke. Like he was just like a mid-range maven. He shot 60% at the basket at Duke. Brandon Ingram was at 53.2. Chris Middleton was at 55% at the rim.
Okay.
The closest really is Jaylen Brown. But here's the problem comparing Jaylen Brown to Brandon Miller in this case. A, I believe Jaylen was like a year younger. B, Jaylen is like a total freak show athlete in comparison to Brandon, who's just like not that. C, Jaylen Brown played in genuinely the worst spaced offense I have ever watched in my entire life on Cal that season coming into the draft. He was playing next to Ivan Rabb and Kingsley Okoro.
Yeah.
And how do I remember the name Kingsley Okoro? It's because of his impact on Jaylen Brown's draft stock, potentially.
I remember maybe it was Hollinger that was just talking about how nobody has ever had his statistical profile that was taken in the top 10 or something like that ever, just with how bad it was. Yeah.
It was crazy. It was genuinely crazy. His point guard was Tyrone Wallace. Tyrone Wallace shot 29.8% from three. Ivan Rabb had shot 2 3-pointers the entire season. Cameron Rooks and Kingsley Okoro at the center position shot 0 threes the entire season. Steven Domingo played minutes. He shot 30% from three. Sam Singer was like supposed to be there, like 6'4", like kind of gunner off the bench. He shot 27% from three. They had Jabari Bird, who shot 40%, and Jordan Matthews, who shot 41%. But no matter what happened, during those games, Jaylen Brown was driving into two bodies at the basket because Ivan Rabb and Kingsley Okoro or Cameron Rooks were right there every time.
And, he and his no handle chance. Was much worse than it is now.
Yes. And his handle was not good enough. Everything like that. So yeah. The Alabama offense on the other end, I think it's a little bit sneaky how the Alabama offense is well regarded for its spacing in general. Alabama's offense, you know, threes and layups. That's their whole goal.
Yeah.
But they always had Charles Bediako with him on the court, who was their defensive centerpiece. He's in this 2023 NBA draft. Can't do anything outside of 4 feet. And then they also had Noah Clowney on the court with them. And by the, at the beginning of the season, especially, teams were letting Noah Clowney shoot from three.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there was a crowd. Like, I think there was more of a crowd on the interior than maybe what people recognize from Brandon Miller.
Yeah.
But like, that offense is so well spaced in terms of where its players are positioned that it's just a little bit different in terms of that context of the situation. Brandon Miller being below the Jaylen Brown line in terms of finishing is like quite scary, I think.
How different is he than Jabari Smith, and who would go higher in this draft, him or Jabari Smith?
I think he would go higher than Jabari. And the reason that I think he'd go higher is because of the handle and passing. I do think that Jabari is a, I know that this didn't bear itself out this year. I thought that Jabari was a better shooting prospect last year than what Brandon Miller is. But I think Brandon is just much more of like that predator wing that's going to hunt mismatches and like try and string out bigs and do stuff like that. He can actually do that. Like, he has real flexibility through his hips. He has real ball handling ability in terms of like stringing guys out and being able to control and ball screens. So I think Brandon Miller would have gone higher.
Okay. I'm going to separate the Thompson twins so that we can talk about them separately so that people can know who we're talking about. So we're going to make a Cam Whitmore sandwich, and we're going to start with Amen Thompson. How does a player that projects as such a bad shooter become an all-star level player in the NBA today? And can it happen?
He has to be Russell Westbrook.
Would Russell Westbrook be Russell Westbrook in today's NBA?
Yes, I think he would be. I genuinely think he would be, because Russell Westbrook was so good at just putting like force on the rim, essentially.
Also, and putting, also, does Amen Thompson have, because what Russ has is, to say that Russ has that dog in him is not even fair to the level of the like fire that exists within this man. Like, he wants to destroy everybody all the time and is driven by that. And not only does he want to kill the person right in front of him on the court, Barry Trammell of the Oklahoman is a dead man in the press conference afterwards, too. Like, how much of that does Amen Thompson have in him? Because that is just the way that he functioned. And it was funny because Russ functioned that way from game one to the end of the season. And then genuinely at exit interviews, he was a delight. Preseason stuff, he's a delight. But then like when the clock starts, it's the entire season of just this like burning inside of him. Like, does Amen Thompson have any of that in him?
Doesn't have. So like Amen Thompson, the intel on the Thompson twins is fantastic, first and foremost. I don't know that they have that, just because I think that like it's probably fair to say they probably don't have that, if only because Russ is a one of one on some level in that regard, right? Like, I would say even LeBron James doesn't have that, right? Russ is,
I just think it took that level for Russ to get to like superstar, MVP, all of that. Like, it just took that drive to get him there.
Yeah. And this to me is the difference. If I could project you that Amen Thompson was going to be the number one, was going to be like Russell Westbrook, he'd be the number two pick in this draft, like unquestionably.
Okay. Yeah.
The two differences here are, I think that from a functional strength standpoint, Russell Westbrook gets way underrated. Like, Russ is a fucking brick house. That dude is strong as hell. Like, he is just going to bully you. He is going to try and go into contact every time. He's going to plow through, and he's just going to go, right?
Yep.
He has that low center of gravity. He has those enormous shoulders. The Thompson's actually, like, Amen Thompson particularly, I think, has a chance to have, like, some, like, really good, like, strong physical shoulders as a driver. But they don't have that center of gravity being lower, right? Which I think is going to hurt them moving up levels.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that Russ had that was a little bit different is he had the counter in the mid range.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that worries me most. Shot.
Yep.
Yeah, the thing that worries me most about Amen Thompson is actually not the 3-point shooting; it's the lack of counter that he currently has in the mid range. Mm. I know that, like, 3-point shooting is sexy and, like, it's cool, but he doesn't actually need it. He is going to pressure the paint so well that it's not going to matter on some level.
Sure.
He needs to be able to stop and pop like John Morant has with the floater, right? He needs to be able to, like, stop, maybe get a floater, stop, maybe shoot a mid-range jumper. He needs the counter, in my opinion, off the dribble. And that's what he doesn't have right now. And that's why I think his floor is actually a little bit lower than what people think. Even if the ceiling, like, if he develops that counter, is, like, immensely high.
Yeah.
I mean, Russell Westbrook's top 50 player of all time. Like,
it's a ridiculous ask for him to be that good. Certainly. Why is he different than what Ben Simmons was when Ben Simmons was good?
Athleticism and twitch, first and foremost. Ben was a power athlete, is like a 6'10", you know, point guard, essentially. I think Amen is similarly going to drive transition play at an exceptionally high level. Here's the other thing. Ben Simmons was an all-NBA player. Like,
he was an all-NBA player.
People absolutely forget that. Hashtag people forget.
Yep.
Ben Simmons was incredible until he got paid and until the back injuries started to flare up and everything like that. So,
yeah.
I think the Thompsons are, I just trust them as human beings at a high level. And I believe in the humans to, like, not sit on their laurels and, like, you know, not, like, get better at certain things within their game. Mm-hmm. They're going to try. Like, having said that, like, here's the other thing. So Robert Canfield, I see in the YouTube comments.
I was gonna ask you this. I was gonna bring it up.
Can Amen play with Cade and Ivy? And my answer is yes, in theory, and I'll explain how in a second. My question is, like, I don't know if he wants to. This isn't like me having intel on that front. It's more like there are two routes to making this work if you're the Pistons and you want Amen Thompson. The first route is, well, you could play him on ball and you could take the ball out of Cade Cunningham's hands more often. I love Amen Thompson. That seems like a bad idea to me, right?
Not only seems, I think that is a bad idea, straight up.
Yeah. The other option is that you could essentially utilize him as, like, a supercharged Gary Payton II who, like, flies around and is, like, setting screens and, like, doing all this crazy stuff. And that's why I bring up, like, I don't know if he would want to do that.
Yeah.
It's not a question of his character or anything like that. It's just genuinely, like, I don't know if he would want to be that guy.
Yeah, it's a question of getting paid.
Yeah.
100%. Those guys don't get paid like that.
No.
I mean, his people would be like, hey, what are you doing? Even if he did, if he came in and he was like super Andre Iguodala for the Pistons and he had them winning games, but he was like their fourth best player because he decided to take a reduced role. Well, fourth best players get paid like fourth best players. And so you just don't want to do that. And he wouldn't do that. And he shouldn't do that. Okay, let's move on.
For what it's worth, I will say, I don't know if he wouldn't do that. I don't know that he wouldn't do that. I'm telling you, these are both, like, really good kids.
Hmm.
It's he shouldn't want to do that, though, and he shouldn't be asked to do that.
He should not want to do that. Yeah. Don't do that. Don't do that. Okay, Cam Whitmore. How worried should I be with that he passed 7 times the entire college season?
I think you might have overestimated. extremely, I think. Yeah. don't even know if extremely is fair, but I'm worried about it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the assist rate is historically low.
It's bad.
You know, a potential top 10 pick. And it's not just the assist rate. It's he catches and surveys. That's what he does. Like, he stops the ball when he catches. Like, he's catching. He might jab step. He might try and rip baseline. He might try and, like, you know, string out somebody and try and isolate, like, with four or five dribbles, like, dance a little bit with it. But, like, he's not keeping that thing moving along the chain. No. Like, it's just not happening. The big question is how much of this was the mess at Villanova and him missing an early part of the season versus, like, him just not having vision. If you watch the McDonald's game, like, he had, like, five assists in that game. If you watch, I think, Jordan Brand, I think he might have four assists in that game. You go back, you watch the Team USA stuff. I think he averaged, like, two and a half assists in that sample. So,
have,
like,
have you been more helped or more burned by McDonald's games?
Oh, absolutely burned. I mean, you can't judge those for shit.
Yeah, in my opinion. Same. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no, 100%. But I do think that it's a real worry, is what I would answer. Yeah. It's a real concern. Having said that, I still really like Cam Whitmore. And you better believe I have him in the same tier as Brandon Miller and Amen Thompson.
Would you take him or Brandon Miller?
Like, it would be somewhat situational, but
in what situation would you take Cam Whitmore over Brandon Miller? How about that? In what situation? With what team? If a particular team had the choice of Houston. Those two. Okay.
If I'm getting, maybe not, because they have Jalen Green already and they have Jabari Smith, that'd be very ball stoppery. I probably would take Brandon Miller if I actually think I would take Brandon Miller if I was Houston. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. Probably, well, Orlando gets a lot of rim pressure as well.
Indy?
Indiana has Ben Mathurin, and that's, like, a lot of ball stopping. They do have Ben Mathurin. Well.
Yes.
Probably Washington.
Like, if Washington found a way to trade up to three or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a case for Detroit taking him over Brandon Miller, to be honest. Like, I think that Detroit, you know, having him as, like, a rim pressure guy along with Jaden Ivey next to Cade Cunningham, like, I think that'd actually really work, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting. Yeah. What do you think of his handle good enough to be the ball has reached its final destination with me and I'm going to take you guys to the promised land?
Not right now, but I think there are enough building blocks for it to get there at some point. Okay. Like, he's not like a Jaylen Brown ball handler right now.
Yeah.
He's like entering the league Jaylen Brown ball handler. He has like real shake. Mm-hmm. He is like very stiff hips. Like, his hips aren't very flexible in my opinion, but he has real shake with the ball. He has like creative crossovers. He's very wide crossovers, which create like high level separation. So, but while like not having it be like wildly loose. So I would say not yet good enough, but will be able to be an impact player, I think, from day one, because he is, I think one thing that gets way underrated about him, he's not just like a above average, like good athlete. I think he enters the league as like a top like 3% athlete in the NBA. Like he's top 15 insane. Athlete in the NBA from day one.
Yeah. There's going to be some crazy highlights no matter where he goes of Cam Whitmore. And he's absolutely sick. It's filthy.
Yeah.
Let's go to the other side of the sandwich. Talk about Asar Thompson. One, my biggest problem with him is I just don't know if it's Asar or Asar. My second problem with him is, does he do, outside of him being a really good athlete, is there anything that he's great at or you think he will be great at the NBA level?
I think for a wing, he is a great passer. Like, I think the way he sees the court and his overall vision, like, I do genuinely think, like, as a secondary ball handler that's, like, making quick reads and everything, I think he is very, very good at that.
Yeah.
And that's why, to me, like, you mentioned the name Andre Iguodala for Amen earlier. I think that, like, that's the Asar role. Like, if I was Asar, I would be trying to be that guy. You know, not Paul George, not, you know, any number of, you know, longer wings who theoretically are shot creators. I think he should try and be Andre Iguodala. Be like an all defense guy who's a great passer, can run the show on offense occasionally. I think so.
Yeah. I tend to agree. And that's why I think that he's, if the Thunder found some way to trade up, like, he fits like a lot of Thundery aspects in the passing, like being one of the number one things about him when I have my Thunder brain on. So
yeah. I think also he's, like, he's super high character again, which is something they really care about. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, I like him a lot. Let's go to Jairus Walker.
Real quick, I do just want to note on Asar before we move on. I'm worried about the half court scoring. I think more than other people are.
How is he as a cutter? How is he?
Good cutter. Really good cutter. Really good transition player. It's creating everything else. Yeah. Okay.
What position does Jairus Walker play in the NBA?
Yeah, so this is the thing that I keep coming back to as well with Jairus. I think his upside is high enough to be able to play across the wings defensively,
mm-hmm.
to where I'm comfortable with him in like the 6 to 9 range or whatever. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's like a pretty real case for like Detroit to take him if Cam Whitmore is off the board.
Sure.
You are who you can guard at the end of the day in the NBA. Mm-hmm. And I think Jairus can absolutely guard 3 through 5, no problems asked. He is so physical. He is so physical that I think it's going to be hard by the time he's like 25 for bigs to get through him. Now, the real question is, like, by the time he's 25, does he still have this mobility? Like, he is like a pretty thick frame.
Yeah.
If he still maintains the mobility while also improving the skill level, there are some all-star-y outcomes there, I think, with him. But for the most part, I think he's just like a super high level winning guy. You know, I hate comparing guys to Draymond Green because I think it's just a patently absurd person to be, because I think Draymond Green's feel for the game and his basketball IQ is basically one of the 10 best ever. I don't know. Yeah. Let's throw that out there. Like 10 best. You could make a case it might be top 5 ever, I think. Mm-hmm. A guy with those tools should not be as good as he is. But he thinks and processes the game so fast that he's able to.
Yeah.
I think Jairus has some of that. He doesn't have all of it, but like his natural reactivity and like his overall mobility and his overall feel for the game defensively in terms of the way he rotates and reacts and scrambles, I think it's really, really high level.
Yeah. Yeah. Defensively, I have zero questions about what he can do. Offensively, why doesn't he put people in the rim more?
Yeah. So like part of it is that like, it just wasn't the role Houston, like they ran him more as like a short roll big, but also he needs to just fucking put people in the basket. Like he's so strong. Dude's a beast. Like go do it, man. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Like that is a real criticism that I think is completely reasonable to be levied. I don't know totally how he scores in the half court right now is what worries me most. Like he doesn't finish well. Like he made 62% of his shots at the basket for Houston, but like he only got there 1.5 times per game in half court settings. That's crazy low. Per synergy, like that is an insanely low number. He loves to settle for that floater. Like,
oh, I hate the floater. There's too much spin moves. It's just like, man, like you could, like you're 250, just get there. Like you were stronger than almost everybody on the court. It's kind of how I felt watching him.
Yeah. And like this could be like a spacing issue. I think that's worth noting. Like,
sure.
Houston's spacing was not awesome. Let's go with, like, they had Marcus Sasser shooting threes, but no other player on their roster shot 35% from three. Jarris was actually like the highest among their other rotation players, you know, shooting 35% from three. Jamal Shedd shot 31. Tremont Mark shot 32. Terrence Arsenault, 25. Jaywan Roberts shot 0. Javier Francis shot 0. Reggie Chaney shot 0. Like, there was never a ton of space for him to be able to get where he wants to or he wanted to. So, like, maybe you can make a case that, like, he's able to get downhill a little bit better in the NBA. But I'll tell you this, like, that's what people – that's the case people made about – DeAndre Ayton, including myself, and it hasn't really worked out. So
yeah, do you think he gets past Indy?
He could. I think like he's very much an option for Indy.
If he gets past Indy, what's the next landing spot for him?
Look, we have no idea what Washington's going to do, just straight up, because they're a new front office.
Yeah.
So I think that's like a total possibility. Like if they're going to re-sign Kristaps, I mean, Jarris is like a perfect Kristaps
compliment,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that I think I would be a little bit surprised if he got past Utah. To be honest. Yeah. Like I think Utah would make a lot of sense for him too.
Anthony Black.
Yep.
Obviously, great defender, awesome passer, processor of the game. Does the slow shot and inability to like be a high level shooter matter that much for him? Or is he just going to be able to do his thing in the NBA anyways?
It matters for sure in the same way that it mattered, that it continues to matter for Josh Giddey. Right.
Okay.
Josh improved a lot as a shooter this year, like undeniably.
Ton. Yeah.
But like you remember rookie year Josh Giddey, like he was thinking faster than anybody on the court. I think AB has like a lot of that. Like he'll do similar things in terms of like thinking the game faster than everybody else.
Yeah.
The shooting is a real concern. And I think that to play as like an off ball player, you really have to be able to shoot on some level. Now, AB is going to move the ball so quickly. Like, similar to Josh. Like, the Thunder's offense was never bad with Josh Giddey out there because Josh is so quick in terms of like processing what's happening around him.
Yep.
Anthony put Black
pressure on the rims too. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, Anthony Black is similar in terms of he will put pressure on the rim. He's a little bit smaller than Josh, which is a little bit of a concern for me. I think Josh is probably a slightly better prospect. Because of that and because of the shooting touch, I think Josh's shooting touch is just a little bit better.
Okay.
But he has that similar thing with Josh Giddey to where he is processing things like full seconds before they happen. You know what I mean? I mean, you've watched Josh even more than I have, but like when you watch him, it's just like, incredibly, it's ridiculous in terms of the way he thinks the game, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It will end up becoming a guy that people get compared to a lot just because he's so unusual. Giddey, you know, it's similar to Draymond because there wasn't like necessarily like the exact Draymond comparison until there was Draymond. And now it's like, okay, now we can compare all these guys that can defend and pass and aren't the greatest scorers in the world to Draymond. And now it's like, okay, now we can compare like these high level big guards to Josh Giddey. And I actually think it's a fair comparison for Anthony Black. I just think he's going to be good. I just think he's going to figure it out. Maybe he's not an all-star level player, but I just think he's going to be a guy that figures out how to play in the NBA and play for somebody. Also, just the dude just wants to win so badly. And I think like that's just such a great quality in an NBA player. So I'm just in. I'm in on him. in almost any situation.
Yeah, I think that most of the guys that will get compared to Josh in the future, it's going to be absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
I think Anthony Black, particularly in terms of the way that he is not just like a good passer on the ball, but also a great passer, like as a connector and like an immediate passing, like, you know, a reader off the ball of what's happening around him constantly. Being able to pass off the ball and on the ball are like totally different things, right? Like Russell Westbrook pounds the ball into the dirt and then, you know, makes these high level passes. And I wouldn't say Russ is a bad passer. He's a great passer, but it's a different style offense when Russ is dominating the ball in that way.
Yeah.
Anthony Black doesn't have to do that to get assists. And same with Josh.
Yeah. You play one way when you play with Russell Westbrook. You can play lots of ways with Giddy and with Anthony Black.
Yeah. I agree. Yep.
Okay, let's start to rapid fire a little bit so we can get through as many prospects as possible. Taylor Hendricks, is he more than just a high-level role player who is like a weak side shot blocker, defender, and shooter?
What I would say is his route to being a higher-level player than that is improving as a ball handler and improving as somebody who can make passing reads. And I'm a little bit skeptical of that, but even if it doesn't happen, I think he's going to be an awesome basketball player that really helps you win games at the end of the day.
Grady Dick. Can Grady Dick defend at the NBA level enough to be able to stay on the court in like closing type moments?
To stay on the court, probably, I think.
Okay.
I don't know about probably. Maybe. The big question that I'm trying to figure out right now is how good of a shooter is Grady Dick? Is he like, he needs to be like 40 to 45%, right?
Yeah.
Or is he 38 to 40%? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If he's that, the rest of the skill set's a little bit less interesting. If he's a 42% three-point shooter sniper, which I think is very possible, I'm a lot more intrigued.
Okay. Cason Wallace, can he be a lead ball handler?
Do you consider Drew Holiday to be the Bucks' lead ball handler?
No.
Yeah, I think it's more like that probably in terms of role. I think Drew's better than he is, first and foremost. I want to say that. I don't love the comparison between the two. I love it on defense. I think Cason is that guy on defense. Offensively, he's just
podcast on unfair comparisons all through through NBA history, because that would be another one like Drew Holiday. It's like, oh man, he's just like Drew Holiday. It's like, well, do we really understand what Drew Holiday does when we say that?
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting idea. I should try and get the players on the pod maybe, and
that'd be amazing. Say like,
basically understand what makes you so good and why it's a ridiculous comparison to like, talk about you as being this. Like, can you imagine Draymond Green like going through all the guys? Hey, yeah, PJ Washington got compared to you at one point.
That would be amazing content. That would be amazing content.
Yeah. But like, you know, bring up like, why are you different kind of thing?
Yeah.
Drew is a prime example of this. The reason that Cason is not Drew offensively is because he's boxier through the hips, in my opinion.
Okay.
And like doesn't shift his hips well enough.
Jordan Hawkins. Can he defend at the NBA level, and is his size going to hinder him in the NBA?
Currently, yes, it will. My biggest point of concern with him is trying to maximize the frame kind of in both directions, right? So if you get him stronger, which you need to do to make him good and viable defensively, does he lose some of the elusiveness and quickness away from the ball that makes him such a valuable floor spacer who can get 3-point shots up at volume, right?
Yeah.
Or if you go the other way and like you keep the frame the way it is because you don't want to lose the 3-point shooting, can he defend at all? I think Jordan wants to defend. Like, you watch his tape, like he's aggressive on the ball. It's just that like he gets blown through his chest, even at the college level. And that's going to happen in the mm-hmm. NBA level. It's the difference between him being Malik Beasley and being like somebody who's like actually like really valuable, in my opinion.
Why is Kobe Bufkin the perfect draft prospect?
Because he's just the most well-rounded of these guards. Like, yeah, we just talked about Anthony Black. Like, I think Kobe can pass. He's not as good of a passer as Anthony Black. You know, I think Kobe can shoot. Probably not as good of shooters, you know, Grady Dick or whatever. I think Kobe can defend. Probably not as good of a defender as, you know, I think off the top of my head, is Kaysen Wallace, right?
Yeah.
But doesn't take anything off the floor.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't take any. Those guys are super, super valuable. The players who don't take anything away from you as a role player in the way that you play, I think it's super valuable.
Does he do it all enough at a high level to make it? Because some of these guys get to the NBA and it's like, oh, they just aren't good enough at one thing to stay on the court.
I think yes, because I think he's athletic enough.
Okay.
It's kind of my answer.
Why isn't he higher then than some of these guys with questions?
I've had him in the lottery like since February, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Like, why wouldn't he be higher than Grady Dick?
I have him ahead of Grady Dick.
Why wouldn't he be higher than Anthony Black? Just because of Anthony Black's like high level defense and high level passing?
So I've actually been thinking about this a little bit. It's a great question. I think AB is a better processor of the game and a better defender. I am more questionable, I guess. The big thing with Black is the frame. Like, Anthony Black is strong. Like, he's physical.
Yes.
Kobe Bufkin is not that, right?
Right.
He is finesse. He's like 185 pounds. Kobe Bufkin might be like the lightest player, if I remember correctly, in my top 100, outside of like maybe like one or two guys. I mean, I can look that up just while we're talking.
I think that's probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. So him and Jordan Hawkins are both 186 pounds.
Okay.
Those are the lightest guys in my top 150 right now, or my top 50, not top 150. Jesus Christ. Top 50.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Because it's a podcast and we're talking about the draft, we have to talk about Bilal Coulibaly. The shot. I just want to ask you about the shot itself. Do you think it can get like smoothed out to where it's like a real weapon in the NBA?
Good, yeah, totally. Absolutely could. I mean, he is somebody that has made shots throughout the course of this year, you know, with Metropolitan, certainly. He's just taking them. He's taking like one and a half of them per game. It's so minimal. I've mentioned this a couple times on the podcast, but like the reason that this is not like a shoe-in as a, you know, surefire top 10 pick. Andrew, you're muted.
I know I am. I'm talking to my 4-year-old. I'm intentionally muted and I'm talking to my 4-year-old on this podcast.
I love that. The reason Coulibaly is not like a, you know, guaranteed top 10 pick is because of his offensive usage right now. Like, his offensive usage with Metropolitans up until this Osvel series that has like blown him up, it's been like Isaac Okoro level. Like, he's taking 5.1 shots per 36 minutes in half court settings, right? And PJ Tucker this year took 4.2. Isaac Okoro took like 5.8. Like, it's been in the middle of those two, right? So that's a very low usage player, and him being able to find a way to like make an impact on offense is critical for his NBA success. The shooting is the easiest way to do that. I think I feel pretty okay that he will be a passable shooter at some point.
Okay.
It might take a year, but I think he will shoot, is my opinion on him. I do. I think
should he be a lottery pick?
I have him. I said this on the show 2 days ago. I have him at 12 right now.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty comfortably. a lottery pick. I'm trying to look and see who else I have questions about. Why? Let's see. Why shouldn't Jaime Jaquez be a first round pick?
Oh, Andrew, I have Jaime Jaquez at 29.
Okay, there we go.
Makes me very happy.
Very good.
I love him. I just love him. Like, I think it's going to work. Like, I mean, he's done, from all reports I've gotten, Jaquez has been so good in the pre-draft process. Like, has been awesome so far. I can't not have him in the first. I had him at 30 on the post lottery mock draft. I have him at 29 on my final board. Look, the upside is somewhat limited, but that dude can really just play. That dude really can just, he knows how to fucking play. And here's the other thing too. Like, since he was a freshman at UCLA, I've been getting reports on, like, he's the guy there. Like, he's like the leader there. He's the guy that, like, really, like, sets the tone. You look at, like, you know, even like the public stuff, like Mick Cronin, after they lost to Gonzaga in the tournament, like, Mick Cronin is, like, incapable of bullshit. And you could tell, and, like, Mick Cronin is, like, not someone who really gets emotional on stuff. You could tell that, like, he has, like, real affection for Jaime Jaquez. And, like, truly, like, thinks that the reason it's gone so well for him to start his, like, first 4 years at UCLA is because he could build around someone like Jaime Jaquez. So,
yeah. We describe his game real quick. We describe his game to people that haven't watched him.
Yeah, like 6'7", 6'6", like, kind of physical wing four man that can really create shots, weirdly. Like, he has, like, these big looping crossovers. He plays it like a strange cadence, kind of, that allows him to separate. Super processor of the game. I think, like, passing numbers, or, like, you know, assist numbers belie his passing ability. I think he can actually, like, pass at a pretty good level. Just knows how to process the game. Really, really smart team defender, all defense guy multiple times in the Pac-12. Worry a little bit about how he moves against, you know, the best players in the NBA athletically, but total stud in my opinion.
I agree with Dirty Dancer in the comments. He feels like a Grizzly in a lot of ways.
I would love it if he went to Memphis. I would love that.
At 25, like, that just feels,
give it
and
to
him. and they'll reach on players that can play like that, you know. They just did.
Took David Roddy last year, man.
Just to get him on the roster. I mean, and I, you know, it kind of ties this back into, like, beginning of our conversation, but he's somebody that I think could and probably should rise, just because he's going to help somebody next season. Like, if you're the Warriors and you're like, man, we just need, like, one more rotation player, 19 feels rich for him, but it's also like, I don't know, if you're Golden State, could you trade back, like, five spots, get, like, an extra something and draft Jaime Jaquez at 26 or something instead?
Well, this is a good way to loop back to our original conversation. So the Warriors particularly have probably been the biggest, the team that should have drafted for role players, but instead chose to draft teenagers team over the last, like, 5 years. The oldest player that they have drafted is, I think, Jordan Poole, who turned 20 a week before the draft. In the last 6 years, I think it's something like Moses Moody, Jonathan Kuminga, Jordan Poole, Alan Smilagic, Ryan Rollins, Patrick Baldwin, and a couple of other guys. All those guys are teenagers at the end of the day. So they just draft teenagers all the time. And you have Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson. Draft guys that are good at basketball.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've got to go because I'm about to go coach 11-year-olds basketball, and they're infiltrating my house right now. So
I love this. This is great.
I want to keep going because this is so much fun. Maybe we should do this again with more guys in the first round. So
we'll do it again. This is super fun. We'll talk about a bunch of guys in the first round. We'll have a good time. Andrew, thank you for coming on. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. Andrew, tell people where they can find you every week.
If you are into the Thunder at all, you can find me on Down to Dunk. You can also find me on the Athletic NBA show. I produce a lot of those shows. You can find me on the Daily Ding for that show, and then also listen to the Saturday Slam and Jam with my guy Alex Spears on Saturdays. So please subscribe. Also go check out the YouTube channel for the Athletic NBA show, something we're trying to grow. So do all of that. I would very much appreciate it.
Go help out Andrew. Andrew is the best. We will be back later this week with more. I don't know when the next show will be. We will find out. Until next time, though, we will talk soon. Bye.